Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Thomas Big Spider. So as I'm about to start recording the podcast, I'm getting ready. I go to hit record, and all of a sudden I see something kind of right in front of my face that I can't quite focus on. So I back up a little bit, and this little like 2-inch house spider just came dangling down by a web right onto my microphone. So we just put him over. I have a pothos growing in here. I just put him, relocated him over to pothos. He can have free reign. I do have a lot of true spiders up in the transfer room because I get little fruit flies at times, or we get some moths sometimes in the roach bins, and they love to eat those. So it works for me. It's like having free pest control. But anyway, this episode, we're going to be talking a bit about Nandu. But before we start, I do want to take a moment to backtrack to last week's episode because I had a really good comment from one of the listeners. And apparently, I wasn't clear on something or didn't answer a question, which I was worried about after I did it, but I honestly figured I must have mentioned it there somewhere, but who knows, sometimes I get on a roll and I forget things. So the question that was asked was, hey Tom, could you just clarify when is the point somebody should think about starting a roach colony? When should a keeper go, all right, maybe this is a good idea? And I think it honestly depends. I think, first of all, I hear a lot of folks that just get into the hobby that currently only have a handful of tarantulas, maybe a couple slings, maybe an adult, and they're like, I'm starting a roach colony. And the good news is it can take a little while if you don't do it right, like we explained in the previous podcast. It can take a little while to get it going. So maybe by then they have a big collection. But I wouldn't say that's enough to really warrant it unless you have, like, I know some people belong to local keeper groups and stuff, and I know one person only had a handful, but they start a colony and they meet with other keepers that have a lot more tarantulas than they got, and they trade, sell them off for, you know, different spiders, for money, whatever. So that's a cool deal. But if you don't have that, like, I wouldn't have a situation, well, I probably could if I wanted to, but I don't have a situation where I really meet a lot of people. So if I had a surplus, I wouldn't be able to get rid of them. So I think when you start, it honestly depends. When you're up to a couple dozen and you have specimens of many sizes, it might be a good time to start thinking about it because it can get expensive. That's the point where you don't have enough tarantulas to buy your feeders in bulk. So if you're using crickets, it doesn't make sense to buy a box of 500 or 1,000 crickets. Plus, you're going to need multiple sizes. So if you buy a box of small crickets, you'll have nothing to feed your larger spiders, and vice versa. So I think that that's the point. I know for me, it was when I had a bunch of different sizes, it was getting expensive to go out and buy 100 large crickets, 30 medium crickets, 20 small crickets, whatever it may be. That's when I'm like, you know what, maybe I should look at getting some roaches. And that's when I got my B. lateralis roaches. And if you're moving into one, I know a lot of folks love dubia. Dubia are great. I have my dubia colony going, but I usually, if you're able to legally keep them where you're at, I like the B. lateralis because once you get the colony going, you have food available for just about any size of spider you would need. So the adult specimens, although most of us will only feed out the males, the females are quite juicy. Females are probably bigger than most large crickets. The males are just around the same size of large banded crickets. The house crickets are probably a little bit bigger, the big males and females, but they're still a good source for if you drop five or six of them into a larger tarantula, it's a good meal for them. And then the baby, I love when I'm raising slings and I have, like, right now, mine are all starting to have babies. I have these little teeny tiny pinheads that are perfectly sized for the smallest slings. Most things will take them. If not, you pick them up, you squish their heads, you drop them in, free meal, perfect. So I like the B. lateralis is one to start off with. They seem to be a little bit easier to raise up. They, again, as I mentioned before, they are something just, I've never had a tarantula refuse them. They have that running, they like to run around, they don't hide, and they elicit those really good feeding responses even for the smaller specimens. So that would be my tip as far as starting a feeder colony. I think for a lot of us, it's when you hit that, you know, around 20 mark, two dozen or so, and especially when you have them in different sizes, it starts to become much more cost efficient to be able to produce your own feeders rather than have to go out and buy a bunch of different sizes of them. When I started thinking about it, and a lot of folks I talk to, that's usually when they're like, all right, you know what, I'm getting up there, I know I'm going to have more, these things are growing quick, it's time to get a feeder colony going. So that would be my tip. Sorry if I wasn't clear on that. I think I started to talk about it and glossed over it. You know, sometimes you're sitting there talking in a room by yourself for an hour, you lose track of where you are. I usually have notes, but every once in a while, I'll bounce around. The other thing I wanted to briefly touch upon is I received an email from Timo Oosterlund. I hope I said your name right. I'm so sorry if I didn't, just let me know and I'll correct it. But Timo says, very interesting topic about the feeders in your podcast. I've been breeding crickets for a while now, and basic things you explained on the podcast, like fresh food, containers, ventilation, works for me too. In addition, I use some vermiculite on the bottom to control odors, and it looks like it controls humidity as well. That's an awesome idea. I've never even thought of that, and obviously I've been using vermiculite since the 90s. Aspen chips seem to do the same trick also, as it's cheaper here in Finland. Also, by feeding them with rabbit and hamster pellets, crushed, gives them the needed protein. It looks like it reduces cannibalism drastically. The animal protein does the opposite. For example, cat food contains animal protein, and crickets seem to be more cannibalistic if they get short on food from time to time. These are just my observations and thoughts. Don't know if others have had the same experience. Best regards, Tim. So thank you, Tim, for chiming in on that one, because quite frankly, I've never thought of using rabbit pellets. And it's funny because years ago, we used to raise rabbits when I was a kid. I obviously know what rabbit pellets are, and that would be a really good dry food. I believe they contain a lot of things like alfalfa and things that would be good for the crickets. They naturally, I think, if I remember correctly, the rabbit pellets themselves actually wick up some humidity out of the air. So if you threw some of those down, it'd almost be like throwing down a substrate and a food source. So I might have to try that one out and see how it works, because anything that would keep the crickets alive, I know there are people out there that breed and raise crickets and don't have the same problems that folks like myself and others that are just trying to keep them alive enough to feed have. I know there's ways to keep them to avoid those mass deaths. So thank you so much for chiming in on this, Tim. I really appreciate it. I am going to pick up some of those pellets. We'll blend them up, see how it works. I don't know if I'll go the vermiculite route, only because vermiculite around here tends to be pretty expensive, and I got a funny feeling that once a few of them die, I'll start throwing them out. Maybe I'm wrong on that one, but if anyone else has tried that, please chime in. Would love to hear it, because obviously there are still a lot of us out there who do use crickets. Would love to know how to keep them alive. So moving on to our main topic today, we're going to kind of be doing a genus review. Unfortunately, there's four species from this genus available in the hobby, and I'm missing one of them. It's a glaring omission in my collection right now. I'm hoping to remedy that soon. I've noticed there's some people out there selling it, so I might have to pick some up, because I'm one of these ones, again, I'm a collector at heart, so when I get three of a species and know I'm missing one, it drives me nuts until I finally pick that species up. So what we're talking about today, obviously, by the title of this one, is Nandu. They are awesome. They are, I think, overlooked. We'll talk about there's pros and cons in Nandu. There's one big con that tends to turn a lot of people off, and we'll get to that more towards the end of the podcast. But currently, there are four available species in the hobby, if I'm not mistaken. There's the hobby staple, in my opinion, Nandu chromatis, or the Brazilian red and white. Wait for these common names. They're awesome. These guys generally have a red abdomen, a grayish carapace, dark femurs, and then almost like a cream bone color banding and striping on the legs. I love these guys. I have to admit, years ago when I was first doing some research on tarantulas, I immediately saw the Acanthus curia geniculata and thought that was gorgeous. And then I saw Nandu chromatis, and I have to admit, at that time, your Acanthus curia people, don't kill me. But at that time, I thought the Nandu looked even better. It was something about the colors, the fact that it wasn't completely white, that had this like bone color to it. Just absolutely love them. And then we'll talk about with the rest of the Nandus. They all have a kind of a common trait of being particularly fluffy almost. These guys are not particularly fluffy. And in fact, I remember years ago when I tried to find the information, I can't find it. I know somebody was talking about the fact that they thought eventually Nandu chromatis would be moved out of this genus of tarantulas. I wanted to find the info and talk about it a bit here, but I couldn't find it. But I just remember that little tidbit. I don't know what came of that. Next one we got is Nandu trapepii, the Brazilian blonde. I fell in love with the species years ago when I picked up one from Tom Patterson. It was a sex female. She is gorgeous. She is fluffy. She is almost a strawberry blonde, just a beautiful, fluffy blonde tarantula. Awesome species. Since then, because I wanted to do husbandry on them, I've been saying for years I want to get slings, raise slings up so I can do a good husbandry video on them. I picked up five slings. They're all doing great. They're all young adults now, about anywhere from about 4 to 4.5 inches, looking great. There's Nandu colorata villosus, or the Brazilian black and white. Nandu trapepii is the Brazilian blonde, just in case I missed the common name for that one. And these guys are similar in appearance and aesthetic to Acanthus curia geniculata. As a matter of fact, when I was first looking them up years ago, again, many, many years ago, I was confusing the colorata villosus with the geniculata. And once I finally got one, I saw there's definitely, you can tell them apart easily, but they have that same general appearance. They generally have a darker brown carapace, thick white to tan banding on the legs. So again, that brings up the ageniculata, reddish color on the abdomen. And again, they're fluffy. So they're kind of a fluffy geniculata, so to speak, which I think kind of makes them look a little extra cool. I don't know. These guys are all amazing spiders. They're all the same, in my opinion, as far as how much I love them. So I don't want people getting upset with me. The next one is Nandu Carapensis or the Brazilian Red. These guys are a deep brown color overall with reddish pink seta, and they're again a bit fluffy, gorgeous little spiders. So almost like chocolatey color with like that those red fluffy hairs all around them. And that's when I looked at pictures of those, and I need to get one because they're just beautiful spiders. Again, the Colorado Velosis, the Trapepii, and the Carapensis, all rather fluffy, and Chromatis not as much, but awesome spiders, great showcase spiders. Now, all these species, I believe they all have very large sacs. As a matter of fact, there was a point where I was thinking about breeding my Trapepii, and then I saw they could have over 1,000 slings in a sac. And I was like, I don't sadly have the time for that right now. And slings actually start off very tiny, about a third of an inch or 0.8 centimeters or so. But the good news is they grow quickly. These are generally fast-growing tarantulas. Now, are they on the same level as a Formictopus or a Zanestis or a Theraphosa or a Pamphibidius? Not quite, but a lower end of the spectrum. I think, and we can say this across the board, with the right temps, the right feeding schedule, you can easily get a 3-inch spider in a year, and some people will end up with a 4-inch spider in the year. So anything that can go from a third of an inch to 3-inch in a year, as far as I'm concerned, is fast growing. Now for slings, super small slings, you want to start in a dram vial. I did that with all 5 and Trapepii. They were super tiny. I was actually shocked because I, for some reason, thought they were going to be larger slings. Super tiny slings, one of those ones that when you stare into the actual dram vial, you're having a hard time focusing on it. It's making your eyes cross. I also did it with both N Colorado Velosis. The first one I got from a pet store. And I remember standing in the pet store, they had the little teeny vial. You could see where it kind of dug a little burrow, and I couldn't see the sling at all. And I'm like, I really want to buy this sling, but I want to make sure that A, there's a sling in there, and B, it's not dead. So I remember we were like poking around, and finally we saw this little teeny sling in the bottom move around. I'm like, okay, I bought it. And I'm glad I did, because I ended up loving that spider. But those definitely smaller slings, I'm a huge proponent of not putting tiny slings into larger enclosures. Like, I know we have a lot out there. Back in the day, the big thing was like all slings, 16-ounce deli cup. Well, if you put a third of an inch sling into a 16-ounce deli cup, you are going to have one heck of a time trying to A, find the sling, and the sling is going to have one heck of a time trying to find food. So that's why I'm always a proponent of the smaller ones. The other things you can use are the five-ounce deli cups, the little souffle cups, or I think they're like made for Jello shots or something. I little larger than a little 2-ounce, not the 2.5 ounce ones. I've stopped using those. I think they dry out way too quickly. The problem is the way the caps fit on them, there's a lot of airflow between that, and you can have one that's moist, and obviously for slings, you want it moist, and a day and a half later, it's completely dry. So I don't use those, but the bigger ones, you can stack a little more substrate in. That would work, throw in a little pinch of maybe moss, sphagnum moss or something, and that would probably work. But again, it's all about recognizing where this sling is, because when I say they're small, they're small. Now, larger slings, a lot of folks will be selling half-inch slings. They'll be selling three-quarter-inch slings. Larger slings, 0.75 inches or 1.97 meters or so, can go into those 16 or 20-ounce deli cups, which I believe is about 0.5 to 0.6 liters. Those are great. I think I've mentioned on my videos and in my podcast, I started buying 20-ounce deli cups. I'm going to be honest. It wasn't like I went, hey, these will be awesome. I tried to find 16-ounce. They didn't have them, or they were more expensive. And I found 20-ounce. I'm like, let me try these out. And I love them because they're a little for smaller arboreals. You can give them that arboreal type enclosure, but it's not as tall as a 32-ounce. For terrestrials, it gives them a little more room to burrow, because let's call it as it is, a lot of terrestrial, the majority of species of quote-unquote terrestrial spiders will burrow as slings. So it gives them some room to burrow, gives them some room up top. Love them. But I will start them off moist substrate for all of my slings. I always keep the bottom layers moist. Again, it's not about keeping the top moist. Although, if you want to put a little pinch of sphagnum, again, that's a nice spot that when you're going in there with your syringe or your pipette and you're trying to moisten things down, you can squirt it on that so it'll absorb some water. And I've seen them come out of their burrows and just, or sometimes they're hiding behind that. I've seen ones that will use that as a burrow. They will web up behind the little sprig of sphagnum moss, and then they can come up and drink right out of that. So, little trick there. Now, I mentioned pipettes or syringes. It's always important that when you're adding, obviously, if you got a little dram vial, it's going to be a little more difficult. You want to try to figure out where the spider is. So if it has a burrow on one side of it, then what you're going to do is take that pipette, you're going to take that syringe, you're going to put it on the other side of it and carefully inject a little fluid into it. Don't overdo it. I've done it before where you get a little crazy with it, you pump it in there, and all of a sudden the burrow fills up with the water, the spider shoots out the top. It's like, what is happening? You don't want to go that far. So you want to make sure you control it, which is why we use a syringe or a pipette. I have a bunch of pipettes. I end up trying to buy some pipettes and I accidentally bought 100 of them. So I've had a bunch of them around. So I've also used syringes. Those work just as well. Now, if you're using a 16 or 20 ounce deli cup, you want to, I would probably put a water dish in there, depending on, you know, if you're using that deli cup, you're assuming it's a larger sling, they will drink out of it. So just a little extra, plus it's a little extra moisture in there for them. So water dish will work. Obviously you can't really do, I know some folks do like Legos and stuff like that inside, and that's great. It's just, they're going to evaporate so quickly, or the chances of some of that substrate, especially if you're using cocoa fiber, is notorious for this. A little piece of cocoa fiber will get into the water dish and people will come in and go, I filled up the water dish and the tarantula drank it all. And I filled it up again, drank it all. No, what's happening is that piece of cocoa fiber is wicking out the moisture into the surrounding substrate. It could also happen with webbing. Although webbing's waterproof, the moisture can follow the webbing and come out. So I've seen tarantulas' water dishes drain in like 2 hours. It's not the tarantula drinking them. Unfortunately, it's the moisture getting wicked out. So as far as feeding, for the teeny tiny ones, you can use flightless fruit flies. You guys all know my take on flightless fruit flies. I try to avoid them when all possible. If you use flightless fruit flies, a trick for you. This is what I like to do with them. I shake a couple of them out into a glass container. I put tinfoil over the top of it. I stick it in the freezer until they stop moving, and then you can shake them out like a salt shaker. So that way you're not sitting there trying to pick. The good old days, I would literally sit there with a pair of tiny tweezers and try to catch those little boogers by the wings and drop them in, and it was a nightmare. And somebody finally said, hey, you know what I do? It works. I chill them first, and it makes them so they basically slow down to the point where they stop moving, and then I can just put them in. So if you're using flightless fruit flies, try chilling them in the fridge or the freezer. Don't do it. If you do it too long, they will die. But just what I do is I put them in there and I just check until they all stop. They shake it around. They stop moving. It's time to take them out. The reason why I use glass is because the glass will stay colder for longer. So if you're feeding multiple slings, what happens is if you don't use glass, everything warms up too quickly. And as you're trying to feed them, you start to watch the other ones wake up. And next thing you know, you're dealing with little lively flightless fruit flies again, where if you use the glass, it tends to stay colder for longer and keeps them dormant. So flightless fruit flies work. I don't use them. For my entrepepii, I used cricket drumsticks. I used pre-killed roaches. I had red runners, little tiny red runners, and I was killing the nymphs. As we talked about earlier, nymphs, red runner nymphs are amazing for tiny slings. I was dropping those in. They were taking them fine. When some time went and I ran out of the tiny nymphs, the nymphs kind of sized out, I would just pre-kill them and drop them in, or again, a cricket leg. Cricket legs, I've found just about everything will feed off of the cricket legs, which is great, because then you don't have to worry about getting that teeny tiny prey. That can be a difficult thing. I know when I first got into the hobby, I was ordering a lot from Jamie's Tarantulas, and sometimes I would force an order because I needed more little roaches. So I'd be like, I need roaches. Let me grab a couple spiders and throw in some roaches. And then eventually that's when I started making my own colony, because I'm like, this is getting ridiculous and getting expensive. So little teeny tiny roaches work. Cricket legs are great. When I figured out the cricket leg trick, it saved me so much time and stress. If you're buying crickets for your larger specimens, before you feed them off, go in there with a pair of tongs, grab the legs as close as you can to the body. They'll usually twist them right off. They'll run away. The crickets are fine. Take a couple of those legs, put them aside, and use those for feeding your tiny ones. I love it. Works great for me. But if you want to go the flightless fruit fly route, perfectly okay, at least at that point. The one thing I have seen is the ones that feed off the cricket legs tend to be a little gun-shy the first time you drop live prey, and they're used to eating the pre-killed stuff, wherein if you use flightless fruit flies and then you go up to something a little bit bigger, they're used to hunting prey, so sometimes they take to live prey a little more quickly. And then when they got a little bit bigger, it was just red runner roaches, just the nymphs. I would drop in the little tiny quarter-inch ones, or a little smaller than quarter-inch, and they would do perfectly fine with those. And again, they eat great. They molt with regularity, which is awesome. And they put on a decent amount of size. It took a little while to get my entrepepii up from that little third of an inch to like a more reasonable half an inch or so. But once they put on, they molt frequently, they put on some decent size. And then once they get to that point, they tend to grow a little more quickly. And then, because obviously they're growing more quickly, we eventually get to the juvenile stage. Now, as for what constitutes a juvenile, it's a bit of an arbitrary term that we throw around. I usually consider a spider a juvenile when the sling sheds its sling colors and starts showing some adult colors. So it's when that patterning starts coming in. With the Nandu species, I found this usually happens around the 1.5 to 1.75 inch mark, or 3.81 to 4.45 centimeters. That's usually when you start seeing that striping show up. That's the point where I usually consider them juvenile. So we could say anywhere from a half inch, 1.5 inches to 2 inches or so, you're looking at a juvenile. All three of my species continue to burrow into the juvenile stage. So you want to give them space to continue to do so. I know folks are going to want to start seeing their spiders more. I know there's always that temptation, or sometimes there's that temptation to put them in something without enough room to burrow so you can see them more, but we want to give them that security that they need. So what I used, the only different container I used was with my N. chromatis, my original N. chromatis, which I grew up, you know, years ago. I think she's probably pushing, I don't know, maybe 9. But back then I was using a lot of the, I think, Walmart M design canisters, or the clear mainstay canisters. That was mainstay. They make a 2-quart one or half gallon one, and they make the 1-gallon one. They're crystal clear. They look gorgeous. The issue I had, I stopped using. Part of it was because of the fact that the overall container is kind of rectangular in shape and the top is round. So when you're trying to get things out of it, it leaves 4 corners up top that the spider can scrunch down in. And it's very difficult to get a brush in there to get the spider out without putting your hand in there. So with species that are more laid back, it wasn't much of a big deal. But for some of like old world species, for some of the more high-strung arboreal ones that I was putting into the 1-gallon ones, it was becoming a little tricky. You can obviously, I've had some folks go, well, just put holes in around there so you can get to them. I just found things that I liked better. So that's something you could use for one. What I tend to use now for my juveniles, what I used for my Entropepii, are the Sterilite, I believe they're called the ID latch enclosures. They measure about 7.5 inches by 5 5/8 inches by 6 inches deep, or 19.4 by 14.3 by 15.2 centimeters. I love these for juveniles. I counted them. There's over 20 of them on my shelves right now. I have everything in them from Myctopus to Ophiopus to Sednocnemus, like you name it. They work great because if you have a terrestrial juvenile, it works great. If you have an arboreal juvenile, a smaller one, they can work for them because they have a little extra height to them. If you have a fossorial species, they work great. They're deep enough that you can put in several inches of substrate, which allows you to keep it moist for longer. They're easy to ventilate. Again, it's Sterilite, so the plastic does have that kind of milkier appearance, so it's not crystal clear. It's definitely transparent, but it's got a little milkiness to it. But they're just so easy. You take a drill, put on a small bit, bunch of holes, you can easily do in a half hour. I think last time I bought a box of 12 of them, in a half hour I had them all ventilated. So it doesn't take long to do it. It's that softer plastic. As long as it doesn't heat up and bog down the drill bit, you're just fine. And they just look great. They're stackable. They're secure. Love the enclosure. So that's what I've been using for mine. But anything around a half gallon to a gallon or so would work great. I've had folks that say they use the critter keepers, the small critter keepers. That would work fine. Just be careful. At this stage, we do want to make sure they have some moisture in there. And obviously, the top opening of the critter keeper with all that ventilation could allow the moisture to evaporate much more quickly. If you want to get something really nice, I generally don't use super nice enclosures for my slings or juveniles, but they make a lot of those sliding magnet topped acrylic enclosures out there. There's probably a dozen people out there making them now, but they make the smaller ones that are like 8 by 6 by 6 or something around that size would probably work fine. But that's what I use, the mainstay ones. I will put in about 3 to 4 inches of substrate, or 7.62 to 10.16 centimeters. And I make sure the bottom layers are moist. Sometimes I just start with moist substrate. I put it in. I let the top dry out. I don't add moisture for a while, just a water dish. But if I do have a batch of dry and moist, I will put a layer of moist on the bottom, dry stuff on top. And then I only add water when I see that dark layer that indicates the moist substrate starts to get a little too low. At that point, when I notice it getting down like an inch or so, I add a little water to just one side of it. And I generally keep one half of it, the lower level moist. I let the other part dry out. And then, as we do with most of our spiders, we put in a cork bark hide. I give them a starter burrow. I want to give them that opportunity to burrow if they would like. And you can even give them more than one cork bark hide. I've been doing that a lot lately. We're putting a cork bark hide on each side so they can choose. It gives them a little more choice, sometimes helps them settle down more quickly. And then definitely this age, I give them a water dish. I either use a water bottle cap, or I've got some for larger specimens. I have the caps I get from like vitamin water and stuff like that. Wash them off, use those. They make great little water dishes for my juveniles. As I mentioned earlier, all of my juveniles burrowed. My Enchromatis burrowed. She still burrows. We'll get to that in a little bit. My N-Tripepii, all five of them continue to burrow. And both of my N-Colorado Velosis also burrowed up to that stage. So I would say at that point, treat them like they're foster girls. Give them the room to dig. If they don't, they don't. And as long as they're eating and they're not freak shows whenever you open the container because they're getting freaked out, they should be absolutely fine. Now, as far as eating, at that point, when they hit that stage, you're talking medium prey items or so. They all had great feeding responses by that point, except for my Nandu Chromatis, who was a bit of a serial killer. We'll get to that in a bit, but they all ate really great at that point. And usually what I would use once they hit about 1.5 inches or 3.81 centimeters or so, I start feeding the medium crickets or medium B. lateralis roaches. Mealworms would also work. You may want to crush the heads so they don't burrow and drop them right in front of them so they grab them, or whatever else you're currently using for prey should work just fine. Now, I found that with all three of these species, once they hit around 2 inches or so, or 5.08 centimeters, they usually start putting on pretty decent size with each molt. This is one of these deals where it takes a little while to get them up there, but then they start putting on really good size. All of a sudden, you've got like little fluffy adults running, some adults running around. So when mine hit around 3 to 4 inches, or 7.62 to maybe 10.16 centimeters, that's the point where I decided it was time to move them into their adult homes. At this point, they look like little adults. They're big. They're eating large crickets, large prey items. They are excellent hunters, and they can be put into larger enclosures with no issue. This isn't like earlier. I had some people go, well, why can you put adults in larger enclosures? Well, because the slings are teeny tiny. They're fragile. We need to see them. They need to find prey. When they're bigger, they're more active. They cover more territory, and it's easier for them to find the prey items. So there are a few different enclosures that one could use to house an adult. I'm going to go over the ones that I've used here, and then we're going to go over one that I haven't used yet, but I think would make for an excellent enclosure. So first of all, my go-to a lot of times with my larger terrestrial specimens are the Sterilite Clearview Latch 15-quart enclosures. I use a lot of these for my large terrestrials. I have a lot of Lasiodora, Formictopus, Pamphibidius, some Zenthus, some Nandu in them. I love them. They run 17 inches by 11 and 1/8 inch by 6.5 inches deep, or 43.2 by 28.3 by 16.5 centimeters. So they offer a good amount of surface area. Plus it's 6.5 inches deep. They do allow you to put 3 or 4 inches of dirt in there or substrate. So although they're not going to be able to do a lot of burrowing, I have had ones create decent burrows in them. They are inexpensive. They are really easy to ventilate. Again, it's that soft kind of milky plastic. That would be the con. They're a little bit milky. And it's easy to go through with a drill a bunch of holes in them. I went and counted before. I have 30 of them in use, and I have 4 more sitting in my garage that are emptied, cleaned out, and ready for more. So I have a lot of these in use. Again, a lot of my bigger species end up in these. I have even some Brachypelma species. The reason why people don't like these, they don't look particularly pretty. They're stackable. So if you have a larger collection, you can fit like my bottom row on my shelving unit is where all of these are, and they're stacked too deep. They're very well secured. I think they're great for the larger specimens. They're just not particularly pretty. The other one I've been using is a Sterilite ID latch, which runs 15 and a quarter by 11 and a half by 6 inches high, or 38.7 by 29.2 by 15.2 centimeters. So slightly smaller than these, not quite as rigid. It's a thinner, a slightly thinner plastic, I think. There's a little more bend to them. The caps aren't quite as secured. They're well secured, but not quite as secured as these. They are a little cheaper. They also don't have as much surface area. I couldn't find the other ones once, so I picked up a batch of these. I think I ordered them online because I was in a spot and I needed some. They've worked out great. I actually have 3 of the M-Tripepii in them now, and they've all been able to burrow in it, which has been awesome. As far as premium enclosures, my N-Tripepii female is currently in a primal cage acrylic enclosure, which measures 16 inches by 12 inches by 10 inches, or 40.64 by 30.5 by 25.4 centimeters. Love these enclosures. I think I have six of them. I bought when the guy first started out the business, and he asked me if I wanted to pick some up, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to put some up. I love the way they look. They are crystal clear. They offer enough depth that you can put in a decent amount of substrate. And with the Trapepii female, I did give her enough room to burrow, gave her a starter burrow. She just didn't use it, but the option was there for her. And I believe now that Tarantula Cribs, other companies, the ones that make the acrylic ones, are starting to come out with like the 12-inch cubes. Those would also work. The Lorax plastic acrylic enclosures would work great. Arachnosis has plenty of things you could use. So if you have a species, a specimen that you want it, you don't mind spending some money for and want to show off, there are a lot of options out there as long as you're willing to spend the money. And then the one thing I haven't put one in yet, but I think would make a great one for it, Exoterra Minis. These are the ones, the 12 by 12 by 12 inch or 30.4 centimeters square cubes, the glass ones. Those, they have the doors in the front. The top, I would say, because they have the screen on the top, replace the screen. I don't care what anybody says. The nice thing is we've covered the screen topic now, and I've had more and more people come in. Just last week, somebody told me they had two arboreal species get caught in it. So there you go. It can happen. Get rid of the screen. Put in some drilled plexiglass. They make excellent enclosures for larger terrestrials. I do not have a Nandu in it, but I have my 7 plus inch or 18 plus centimeter plus M. robustum in one. That's a burrowing species, and she had plenty of room to burrow. I have an Orphanacus species Pinnae blue in it. Plenty of room to burrow. I think these are ones you just have to be a little creative when you put the substrate inside, because obviously the dirt, they have a litter dam in the front that's about 3 or 4 inches off the base. So you can only make it about 3 or 4 inches in the front before you cover up those vents beneath the front door. However, you can angle it up so it's much deeper in the back and get creative, put like a cork bark round in there as a burrow entrance that leads into that deeper part. It can work great. So I think those would actually work really well for Nandu species. And again, if you play your cards right, you can usually find them on sale at places and cheaper, especially at expos. A lot of times they have them for cheaper, for like $50 or so. I think the ones I got, I ended up with 4 of them. I didn't pay more than $50 for any of them. So just keep your eye out on Amazon or another sites and see if you can find them when they're less expensive, because you can, depending on when you go on Amazon, they jack the prices up on them. But those would also be good. Now, as far as setting up the enclosure, depending on the container you're using, obviously, if you're using one of the more shallow Sterilite, you won't be able to put 5 inches of substrate. But 4 to 5 inches or 10.16 to 12.7 centimeters of substrate would work. I start by keeping part of it moist. And then usually what I do is I let things dry out a little bit before moistening down part of the substrate again. I don't usually let it dry out completely, but it has a couple times with my Trapepii female dried out completely. She's always got a water dish. Let's put that out there. But then what I'll do is I'll go and I'll make it rain in one corner of it, soak down one of the back corners. She doesn't seem to show it any preference. And I've noticed with the Trapepii young adults I have now, it's kind of the same thing. Again, always put a water dish. A nice big water dish is great. If you're going to keep it on the drier side, bigger water dish will do you some good as far as making sure that they've always got access to clean water. Cork bark hide or two with starter burrows. Doesn't hurt to give them a choice of which side to go on. And I like to put in the leaf litter. I like to put in the sphagnum moss. It's more for me an appearance and aesthetic thing. As I've spent more time in the hobby, I like the more naturalistic looks to my enclosures. Would I put a plant in? A pothos might work. This is one of the species I kind of wonder if they just dig it all up, because mine tend to get, like, they like to tear things up. I know my Trapepii at one point, I had a fake plant in there, and she ripped that down and dragged it across the enclosure. So who knows if it'd work. If you want to try it, or if you have tried it, let us know. And as far as feeding, they're voracious eaters. They love to eat. The only one that's been a little bit shy for me is my Nandro chromatis. Like, if she's out in the open, I drop praetums in there, she'll run down into her hide, and then she'll gobble everything up. She's a little shy with it. But all the other ones have been amazing eaters. At that point, when they're, you know, 3 inches or so large, for a 3-inch one, you give it a large cricket or two. For the adults, several large crickets, several adult B. lateralis roaches. If you're using males, 4 or 5 males at least, it's not as much as maybe 4 or 5 crickets as far as overall food, because there's a lot of wing and stuff in there, but that would work. Or adult dubia. Females, obviously big and juicy. I hate feeding out the females. I get attached to them. Males, still pretty big and juicy, but that's a nice after molt meal for them when they're ready to kind of fatten them up a little bit, and then you can go back to your normal feeding of crickets or whatever. Superworms work. Obviously, they're bigger spiders, so you're going to need bigger ones. Make sure you crush the heads, because superworms can bite. And locusts. We unfortunately don't get those in the U.S., but I know you guys overseas have them. I'm very jealous. Not only do they look pretty, some of them like these beautiful greens and yellows, but they look like they'd be nice, juicy food sources for your tarantulas. And again, the temperament-wise, and temperament may always vary from specimen to specimen. I found that mine are all generally, they're visible. I mean, if you're worried about my N-Cremaster is the only one that doesn't burring, but I always find her out. They can be a little skittish. My N-Trip-Epi is the one that's got a little bit, I won't say attitude, but she's a little more inquisitive. But I haven't had them kick any hairs, and we're going to get to why that's a good thing in a moment. They're just generally, if they get disturbed, they kind of run to their burrows and hide. That's about it. They're not, like my Formictopus, when I open up the enclosures, most of them will just sit there. They don't move, they don't budge, they don't seem to do anything. They just sit there. These guys will be like, oh, something's going on. They might flatten out for a minute. They might run and bolt. A little lively. I've had other folks tell me there's a little more prone to kicking hairs, a little more defensive. Just keep in mind they can be big spiders. I believe all of them get to be at least 7 to 8 inches or so. I think 8 is on the big end, but overall not really that difficult to work with. Now temperatures in winter, it's usually around 73 degrees Fahrenheit or 22.22 degrees Celsius. It can dip for a few hours. Sometimes during the winter, we have this thing where the main house takes priority as far as the heating. So if it's super cold outside, the heat is working in the main house, and sometimes it goes off a little bit here. We figured out finally how to fix that. But we had some times where the temperatures would drop in the tarantula room for several hours. Sometimes it would dip to 60 degrees or 15.6. That they've done just fine through that. In the summer, it's mid 70s to 85 or 23.3 to 29.44 degrees Celsius. And again, that's usually when they're active, molting, and eating a lot. So what are the pros and cons of Nandus? I think sometimes they get overlooked. And it's kind of a shame because they're amazing spiders. I remember grabbing my first N-Chromatis, and it seemed like I was seeing pictures of them everywhere, but nobody was talking about them, and I couldn't figure it out. But pros, they're all gorgeous. They're absolutely gorgeous with the striping, even the ones that don't have the striping, like Nandu carapensis, Nandu trupepii, they don't have the striping, but they're just colors and their fluffiness is gorgeous. And then Colorado velosis, Chromatis have the striping. Chromatis, I think, are just absolutely stunning. I had somebody tell me they were boring spiders once. I couldn't figure that out, but then I found out they like the Canthoscuria geniculata. So no, totally can't. I'm starting a war here between Nandu and Canthoscuria, but when they're just generally, I like to mention them together because I think they're all very similar looking spiders, and somebody that likes one should like the other one. That's at least my opinion. I like both. I have both. I love both. But they're gorgeous spiders, gorgeous looking spiders. As we said earlier, they eat great. They are fairly fast growing overall, so even if you get the teeny tiny sling, you're going to have a decent size, at least a decent size juvenile on your hands after a year or so. Super good eaters. Super hardy. I think this is overlooked a lot. These spiders are tough. They're up there with Lazy Dora as far as ones that, is, in my opinion, are really adaptable to a myriad of conditions. You don't have to keep them overly moist. They eat anything that eats great, grows quickly, and isn't super moisture dependent, makes for a really good sling to raise up. I mentioned I just did my video on, I rehoused Acanthoscuria geniculata, and I did my Nandu Colorado velosis, and I talked about both of them would be good beginner slings for somebody looking to keep their first sling for the first time. Keep a sling for the first time, they'd be really good because they're like bulletproof in terms of husbandry. They grow quickly. They have all those things you'd want for somebody just starting up that's still kind of a little worried about keeping a sling or growing up a sling for the first time. And they're visible as adults. All of mine are out in the open. Again, the shyest one is the M-Chromatis, but I'm looking over there right now. She's sitting right out in the open again. If I go over and disturb her, try to open her enclosure, she'll run and hide in her burrow. But I can see all of them at any given time, and they're gorgeous. So I think those are all big pros. As far as cons, they can be a little skittish and high-strung. I've heard folks saying there's bolting around, there's throwing hairs. Speaking of the hairs, we alluded to this at the very beginning of the podcast. The hairs, for many, consider the hairs to be some of the nastiest and worst out there. And that's one thing that might keep them from being a beginner species, because a lot of times beginners kind of poo-poo the whole hair thing. It's like, ah, it's hairs, who cares? They can supposedly be very, very nasty. The big one is Nandu chromatis. That's the one I usually hear a lot of people talk about being the nastiest as far as hairs, but I've also heard the whole genus of them. They can be problematic when you get haired. I think one thing to remember is that different people are affected differently by certain species. So for example, I just talked to a guy who has LPs, no problems with LP hairs. They don't bother him. LP hairs bother me a lot. Zanesta species hairs, just opening that, I itch. I've heard other people, no problems whatsoever. Nandu have never bothered me. I've been exposed to hairs before, not an issue. Other people, blistering, itching, burning, very uncomfortable. I've heard from folks that flat out will not keep Nandu species because the hairs to them are so nasty. So it's one of those things, it's kind of a roll of the dice. You won't know how you are affected by the hairs until you actually keep one and get exposed to it. So that can be problematic to some who don't want to necessarily grow up an adult spider and realize I can't go anywhere near this thing. thing because it burns and itches. And they get big. That would be the other. I put that as both pro and con. It's a pro because a lot of people like big spiders. It can be a con because some people aren't a fan of the bigger, you know, a little more skittish spiders. Just something to keep in mind. But I find them to be awesome. It's one of those things that I'm shocked that they aren't more popular. Like people aren't talking about them more. To me, they're just stunning and just awesome tarantulas. Now, a couple notes about specific specimens that I keep just kind of for fun. My Nandu chromatis, that's one I've had for, I got to do the math on it. I'm guessing it's at least 8 years, maybe closer to nine. Picked it up as a well-started sling. And at that point, I originally had her in the mainstay container. She did a lot of burrowing. She was eating great. She outgrew that, and I put her in one of those plastic shoe boxes, the ones that are like, I don't know, about the size of a shoebox or plastic. How's that? So I'm not going to bother doing the inches or centimeters on that. Gave her enough substrate to dig in, put her inside. And what happened was this was the one where I was dropping in crickets. They were disappearing. She was doing great. Dropping in crickets. Okay, everything's going great. Then one day I come in, and there's all these flies everywhere. I'm like, where are these little flies coming from? Usually it happens when you get a dead prey at them that you miss. So I'm going around, sniffing through all the enclosures, can't smell anything. I pull out her enclosure, open up, and this cloud of flies come out. I'm like, oh no, she's dead. No, she wasn't. She was sitting right there. She was perfectly fine. I'm looking around the enclosure. They all seem to be coming from this one corner. So I take a pair of tongs, and I kind of brush away some of the substrate in the corner. I found about 5 bodies of crickets. She had killed them, eaten the heads off, and left the bodies there. Now, at the time, I thought, oh no, she's dead. If a spider has an issue with its sucking stomach, this can sometimes happen. They'll try to eat, they'll crush the thing up, but they won't get anything out of it. They're not able to suck the fluids out of it. And I'm like, oh no, she's going to die. But she continued to eat their heads off. She molted, and she was perfectly fine. So she was eating. She was just eating their heads off. It was the weirdest thing I think ever had a spider done. I love her because of it, because it was such a creepy, freaky, weird thing for the spider to be doing. She was catching them, eating their heads off, and somehow leaving the bodies intact. And that's what was decomposing in the corner, was her little, you know, hidden graves with all her dead cricket victims. So that one always cracks me up. She's also one that still uses her burrow. I have her in one of the acrylic Lorex enclosures, which I don't even know why I didn't put that in there. I mentioned it as one of the adult ones, but I just realized I have one in it. She's in the 5-gallon one and does great in it. She's got about 5 inches or substrate or so, has a little burrow on one side, and she stays in that or runs to that when she gets frightened. But most times she's right out on the surface. So awesome spider. The other one that's worth talking about is my adult female Entrepepii. She was the one that kind of won me over to the Trapepii, because she is so lively, just a bit skittish, sort of inquisitive. I know I'm anthropomorphizing here, but she's one of the ones that'll kind of come out and explore, kind of move towards you when you open the enclosure and just sit there. She's the one that one time I opened the enclosure to feed her, I turned around and grabbed a cricket, and she was just curled over the edge, just kind of watching me. But awesome, beautiful spider, awesome showcase spider. Love the blondes. Just amazing. And now I have the little babies up, and they're all kind of showing the same type of traits. Very bold, kind of out there in the open. They all have burrows, but they'll all be out when I go to open them and feed them. And a lot of times they'll come out when I open the burrow, when I open the enclosure, because it's almost like they know feeding's coming. As far as the Colorado Velosis, my first one I bought from a pet store, as I mentioned, teeny tiny sling. It grew rather quickly, though. I remember I was never seeing it. I would drop in pre-killed prey or cricket legs, would never see it, and then suddenly I open up the vial, and there's this like inch and a half size sling right up top. Like, whoa, so we had to resize it. So we resized it, I believe, originally into one of the Sterilite containers, and then I put it into one of the M-Design acrylic containers that have the hinge tops. And it was in that. I thought I had a female, but again, I don't sex a lot of myself. I just roll the dice. Sometimes I'll pull something out. If I'm super curious, I'll pull it out. But this one, I just assumed I had a female, but then it molted. It was a male. It lived for like a year after that, unfortunately. And it was one that continued to use its burrow. And I actually, when it finally passed away, it passed away inside its burrow. But it was very, very visible. I was so disappointed when it was a male, which is why I have this new sling, because we're going to grow this one up. And hopefully I get a lady this time. But that made me fall in love with that species. And like, I need another one of these in my collection. So when I saw them at a show, it was only $10. It was a steal. And they're also another thing to mention, most of these guys, with the exception of the Carapensis, are rather inexpensive as slings. So that's a good thing. And I picked up a $10 sling. I'm raising it up now. We just did a rehousing video, and hopefully I get a lady. So love Nandu. Hopefully some folks will, again, the podcasts are fun because I can talk, and talk. I don't need to come up with videos for it. but you don't have the visuals. And I think if you could see what these spiders, for folks that are familiar with them, hopefully you're shaking your heads going, yeah, they're gorgeous spiders. For folks who aren't, hopefully you do a quick Google search and check some of these out. I think you'll be impressed. I think you'll look at them and go, that's something I'd like to keep. For people who are looking to keep slings for the first time, give them a look-see. I think they are ones that warrant that attention because, again, they have all the things you'd want for a first-time sling. They're hardy as heck, grow rather quickly, eat great. You know, it's not going to be long before you have a big, beautiful spider on your hand. So Nandu, also, I do have to get a Carapensis, and maybe I'll revisit this after I get my Carapensis because I do want all four of them. I was actually looking up pictures of Carapensis when I was writing up the descriptions of the different species before writing my notes, or when I was writing my notes for this, and getting jealous that I don't have one and upset that I don't have one because they're stunning. So Nandu, awesome. Check them out. Give them some love. Share the love. If you hear this podcast and you have Nandu, chime in. Let folks know these are spiders they need to be checking out. Tell me which ones you got. What are your experiences with them? How do you keep them? What do you keep them in? Share with everybody. That'll about do it for this one. And as far as I've mentioned this a couple times, my last YouTube video was Acanthus scuria geniculata. It wasn't a full husbandry video, but it was kind of rehousing and notes. I can't help but talk about some husbandry as I'm rehousing. And my Nandu Colorado villosus, we got that. So if you want to see a picture or see some footage of the Colorado villosus, definitely check that video out. Obviously, you can find me on thomasbigspiders.com. You can find me on Thomas Big Spiders podcast. You can leave comments on Spotify, and a lot of folks have been doing that, which is great because I just think it makes the page look a little more official when you go on and people are actually interacting with it. And if you have experience with these guys, again, drop a comment. Let us know. That will do it for this one. As always, stay safe. Hope everybody has a great week, and we'll catch you next time.